Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Proverbs chapter 24, which I will call Proverbs of Solomon part 15. We begin in chapter 24 by reading the first seven verses. Do not be envious of evil men, nor desire to be with them, for their minds devise violence and their lips talk of trouble. By wisdom a house is built, and by understanding it is established, and by knowledge the rooms are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. A wise man is strong, and a man of knowledge increases power. For by wise guidance you will wage war, and in an abundance of counselors there is victory. Wisdom is too exalted for a fool, he does not open his mouth in the gate. Now this is a collection of proverbs all munched together here that I've considered as a group, mainly because we've considered similar proverbs almost everywhere. We'll start in verse 1. Do not be envious of evil men, Solomon says. He says the same thing in Proverbs 24:19. Do not fret because of evildoers or be envious of the wicked. David, his father, said the same thing in Psalms 37, verse 1. Do not fret because of evildoers. Do not be envious towards wrongdoers. Proverbs 23:17. Solomon says, do not let your heart envy sinners, but live in the fear of the Lord always. Don't be envious of the wicked. Why would you be envious of evil men? Why would anybody be envious? Well, because a lot of times they're wealthy, they're famous. I mean, you might think, well, look at Hugh Hefner. He's living in a big mansion. He's got all those beautiful blonde babes running around him all the time. Well, anybody that would be envious of that is obviously ignoring the evil, the corruption, the filth, the jealousy, the hatred, and all that's going on behind the doors in those Playboy mansions. And a lot of times these playmates get out and they start telling their story, writing their autobiographies, and it's a nasty, nasty, nasty thing that goes on inside those Playboy mansions. So don't be envious of that. Don't desire to be with them. As John Gill says, you wouldn't desire to be with them in hell. So don't desire to be with them now. I thought that was a pretty good comment. Why do you want to hang around with wicked people all the time? Their minds devise violence, the lips talk of trouble, so why do you want to be around them? Now in verse 3, Solomon says, by wisdom a house is built. What kind of a house? A physical house? Probably not. Probably a family. By wisdom a man's family is built. Now of course the next few verses talk about physical houses, but I don't think the context rules there. I think that's just a metaphor talking about building up one's house, and of course, or building up one's family, and of course, that's where a family has to live, in one's house. Now, Solomon has exhibited the same sentiments in other Proverbs. Proverbs 9:1, he says, wisdom has built her house. She has hewn out her seven pillars. Proverbs 14:1, the wise woman builds her house, but the foolish tears it down with her own hands. So building a house is done with wisdom. Verse 4, by knowledge or wisdom, the rooms are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. Again, the idea of associating wisdom with riches. Wisdom is said in other proverbs to be more valuable than diamonds, silver, and gold. Verse 5, a wise man is strong, and a man of knowledge increases power. There's where that old saying comes from, knowledge is power. It ultimately comes from this. Somebody else might have said it in the meanwhile. Verse 6, for by wise guidance you will wage war. If you have wise counselors who have knowledge, that gives you power, because you can then wage successful war. And in abundance of counselors, there is victory. Well, here's some other scriptures that illustrate the sentiment in verse 5, that a wise man is strong. Proverbs 21:22, Solomon says, a wise man scales the city of the mighty and brings down the stronghold in which they trust. So not only is wisdom more valuable than diamonds, silver, and gold, wisdom also makes somebody strong, strong enough to tear down a city. Solomon says in his other book, Ecclesiastes 9:15-16, but there was found in it a city, a poor wise man, and he delivered the city by his wisdom. Yet no one remembered that poor man, so I said, wisdom is better than strength. Wisdom is better than strength. But of course, Solomon then goes on to say, but the wisdom of the poor man is despised, and his words are not heeded by dumb people, by foolish people. Don't understand that wisdom is power. You can defend a city with wisdom. You can win a war with wise counselors. Verse 7, wisdom is too exalted for a fool. He does not open his mouth in the gate. And the gate is where you had lawsuits in the gate of an ancient city back then. And you had to be wise enough to participate in the debates. Not only lawsuits, but also political debates too. And a fool would be exposed as a fool if he opened his mouth, so he keeps it shut. Of course, there are other verses that say that folly does not keep their mouth shut. But sometimes a fool is so foolish, he can't even open his mouth to expose his folly, because he would immediately be condemned as a moron. We go now to Proverbs 24, 8 through 9. One who plans to do evil, men will call a schemer. The devising of folly is sin, and the scoffer is an abomination to men. Now notice here the premeditated acts of doing evil, one who plans to do evil. He's a schemer. A schemer is one who plans. The devising of folly, he's thinking about it. Most people do evil often because they just fall into it. They don't really plan it. It just comes natural to them and they do it. They're weak and misguided sinners. But to actually, in a premeditated fashion, to plan evil shows a special kind of sinner, as John Gill says. Now notice this proverb says nothing about actually carrying out the plans. It just talks about planning to do evil, but it's still evil. A conspiracy to commit a crime is still a crime, even in the law. A sin is a sin, even if the plans are not consummated, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. Just thinking about sin is sin. We go now to Proverbs 24, verses 10 through 12. Solomon says, if you are slack in the day of distress, your strength is limited. Deliver those who are being taken away to death, and those who are staggering to slaughter. Oh, hold them back. If you say, see, we did not know this, does he, meaning God, does not consider it who weighs the hearts? And does he, God, not know it who keeps your soul? And will he, God, not render to man according to his work? Now, verse 10 is a little bit troublesome. If you are slack in the day of distress, your strength is limited. What does that mean? Well, Ellicott says that that means you are so weak, you can't help yourself, you can't help others. That's why you're slack, because you're afraid. So this verse is an exhortation to courage. Don't let your strength be weak, but, in verse 11, deliver those who are being taken away to death, and so forth. So what Solomon is saying in verse 10 is, you want to be weak? Well, then be slack and don't help people out. The implication is, don't be weak. Now, verse 10 proves that it is normal for good people to have distress. I'm assuming they're good people. It could be they're just cowards or lazy. They don't want to help people. But even righteous people have distress. So good people should be strong during times of distress, because they're going to happen. The day of distress. Solomon talks like, of course, the day of distress is going to arrive. It always does. So the person who should strengthen himself is supposed to help other people, deliver those who have been taken away to death, those who are staggering to slaughter. I can't help but think of an economics professor I had whose mother grew up in Auschwitz. During the war, World War II, she told her son that the air was filled with the smell of burning flesh as the crematories, as the gas ovens burn up the Jews, and the clouds filled the air. And her son asked his mother, well, didn't you know what was going on? And she said, no, we didn't know. We didn't want to know. They just shut their eyes to it. I never forgot that. It was worth the whole class. Well, verse 12 says, if you see people being led to slaughter, God, who considers the hearts, knows about it, and he's going to render to you according to what you have done. He keeps your soul. He preserves your soul, but he's going to deal retribution to you for what you've done by letting these innocent people go to slaughter. And I'm assuming that the person who is letting the people go to slaughter know about it and can do something about it. And I can't help but think of the relevance for those voters, Christian voters, some of whom, who turn their head as millions of babies are being aborted, and go right ahead and vote for people who believe in baby killing. Happens all the time. You can read the websites. Do a search on liberal evangelical and you'll read the websites. Well, you know, not a big deal. If our man is advocating the murder of babies because he wants to spend money for the poor. We go now to Proverbs 24, verses 13 through 14. Solomon says, my son, eat honey, for it is good. Yes, the honey from the comb is sweet to your taste. Know that wisdom is thus for your soul. If you find it, then there will be a future, and your hope will not be cut off. Honey, of course, is good, is sweet, as anyone who has tasted honey knows. Solomon says in Proverbs 25:16, if you found honey, eat only what you need, that you not have it in excess, and vomit it. It's sweet, but too much sweet will make you sick. Proverbs 25:27, it is not good to eat much honey, nor is it glory to search out one's own glory. Not wrong with getting a little bit of acclaim and recognition, but pretty soon you get too much of it, it's going to go to your head and ruin you. Well, those other proverbs in the next chapter warn against too much honey. But here in verse 13, Solomon says, honey is sweet to your taste, and he compares that honey to wisdom for your soul. It's sweet. If you find it, then there will be a future. You know, we're often exhorted to only live a day at a time, as Jesus did in the Sermon on the Mount. But Solomon mentions a lot of times about a future, hope. Hope is the confident expectation that something good is going to happen in the future. Your hope will not be cut off, says Solomon. So there's nothing wrong with expecting good things to happen in the future, even as you deal with the worries of today. Here's some other scriptures about hope. Proverbs 23:18. Surely there is a future, and your hope will not be cut off. Psalms 37, verses 37 through 38. This is a psalm of David. Mark the blameless man and behold the upright, for the man of peace will have a posterity. This is talking about the future of his family, not himself personally. But transgressors will be altogether destroyed. The posterity of the wicked will be cut off. So the idea is your family after you will be blessed. In that same chapter, Psalms 37, David says, for the Lord loves justice and does not forsake his godly ones. They are preserved forever, but the descendants of the wicked will be cut off. The righteous will inherit the land and dwell in it forever. That's talking about the descendants of the righteous as well as the righteous himself. Your hope will not be cut off, Solomon says in verse 14 of Proverbs 24. That reminds me of the Latin motto that is the motto of my home state of South Carolina. Dum spiro, spero. While I breathe, I hope. You can see it on some license plates. You cut off a man's hope, and he's a dead man. That reminds me of a book, a very famous book by Viktor Frankl, a psychiatrist, a Jewish guy who got caught by the Nazis and was put in an internment camp, a concentration camp. And he said they lived on hope to get out of there one day. And he said when somebody just gave up and didn't get out of bed, they knew he was a dead man. He was not going to live. And they would always go over there, get out of bed, get out of bed. I never forgot that. You got to have hope when things go bad. Solomon says in Proverbs 24:13, if you find it, find wisdom, then there will be a future. Notice that you have to find it. It doesn't come floating out of the heaven and landing in your lap. Wisdom does not do that. John Gill says there may be some difficulty and trouble to attain it, to attain wisdom, in the use of means by reading, hearing, prayer, and meditation. You have to work at it. You have to want it. That's probably why you're listening to this podcast, to try to glean some sort of wisdom that you didn't have before. You go find people who know more than you, who are older and wiser than you, and you ask them, what do you think about this? You got to find wisdom. It's a cost to it. Don't sell it after you buy it. We mentioned that earlier proverb in a previous chapter. We go down to Proverbs 24, verses 15 through 16. Solomon says, wicked man, don't set an ambush at the camp of the righteous man. Don't destroy his dwelling. Though a righteous man falls seven times, he will get up, but the wicked will stumble into ruin. The implication here is, it is useless to try to knock a righteous man down. You knock him down seven times, he will get up seven times. By contrast, the wicked, they fall down one time, they're ruined. They're not going to get up seven times. Now, there's a question of how a righteous man might fall seven times. Option number one, he might fall into outward troubles, and he arises from those outward troubles seven times. Now, Ellicott, the commentator, affirms that option. The other option is the righteous man might fall into sin seven times. Many commentators say that, actually. But he gets up from that sin seven times by repenting and so forth. Well, that is problematical. A righteous man, how does a righteous man fall into sin seven times? Well, you might say, as Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 7:20, indeed, there is not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and who never sins. Well, sure, if you're talking about perfect righteousness, then sure, a righteous man falls seven times. But I don't think that's what Solomon meant. I think he meant falling into trouble. I like Ellicott's option there. He will get up. It doesn't say he will get up seven times, but it is strongly implied by Solomon. He will get up. Here's some other scriptures that are similar. David's Psalm 34, verse 19 says, many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. The righteous man will get up because the Lord delivers him seven times. And by the way, seven is not to be taken literally. Seven is just a Hebrew idiom that means a lot, a symbol of perfection, completion. He'll get up every time. Eliphaz in Job 5:19 says, "From six troubles he will deliver you, even in seven evil will not touch you." That's the Hebrew way of saying something completely six times with the seventh time. We go now to Proverbs 24, verses 17 through 18. Solomon says, "Do not rejoice when your enemy fails." We go now to Proverbs 24, verses 17 through 18. "Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, or the Lord will see it and be displeased and turn his anger away from him," and turn God's anger away from the enemy. The implication is, as Gill and Clark say, once God has turned his wrath away from a man's enemy, he will turn his wrath in towards the one who is rejoicing over the fall of that enemy. So this is a strong exhortation not to rejoice when your enemy stumbles. There are other scriptures that say that. Obadiah 1, verses 12 through 13. Obadiah is inveighing against the Edomites, who, as you know the story in Genesis, are the cousins of the Israelites, a collateral branch coming down from Isaac, who had Jacob, the Israelites, and Edom, or Esau, who is the ancestor of the Edomites, so they were close. Verse 12 in Obadiah 1, "Do not gloat over your brother's day." In other words, Edomites, don't gloat over the Israelites' day. "The day of his misfortune, and do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Yes, you, do not gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster, and do not loot their wealth in the day of their disaster." Okay, there's Obadiah saying don't gloat when the Edomite's enemy falls. Proverbs 17:5 says, "He who mocks the poor taunts his maker. He who rejoices at calamity will not go unpunished." So you see somebody that goes bankrupt, an evil person, and you say, "Hot dog," and you start rejoicing at it. Solomon says, don't do that. Job says in Job 31, verse 29, "Have I rejoiced at the extinction of my enemy or exulted when evil befell him?" Rhetorical question. Job is saying, no, I did not, because that would be bad to rejoice when my enemy goes down. Well, that sounds nice. There's a nice German word for that, Schadenfreude, if I pronounced it right. Who knows if I did, but it's a new word. I use it too much because I just learned it on coming back from China, and I found out everybody else was using it, and so I'm getting in on the trend. It's a great word, to rejoice when your enemy goes down. I have to admit, that's a hard human emotion to avoid, but God says don't do it. But now I'm going to raise a problem. There are some scriptures that do allow for rejoicing over one's enemy's downfall. Let me give you some examples. Exodus 15:1. "Then Moses and the sons of Israel sang this song to the Lord and said, I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted, the horse and his rider. He is hurled into the sea." I mean, Moses and the sons of Israel not only rejoiced over the fall of their enemies, the Egyptians, they wrote a song about it. I've sung that song many a times in my earlier years. It was made in a nice little chorus that we sang all the time in the key of C, rejoicing. Revelation 18:20, "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her." That's the great city, Babylon, apostate Israel, in my humble opinion. "Rejoice over her. She'd been burnt down to the ground by the Romans in AD 70. Rejoice over her, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her." That sounds sort of contradictory to what we've been talking about, don't rejoicing. That sounds sort of contradictory to these scriptures which I just read, which prohibit rejoicing over the fall of one's enemies. How about this in Revelation 19, 1 through 2? "After these things, I heard something like a loud voice of a great multitude in heaven." This is John the Apostle speaking. "That great multitude was saying, Hallelujah! Salvation and glory and power belong to our God, because his judgments are true and righteous. For he has judged the great harlot who has corrupted the earth with her immorality, and he has avenged the blood of his bondservants on her. Hallelujah!" Well, isn't that rejoicing over the fall of Babylon the Great? Psalms 58:10, "The righteous will rejoice when he sees the vengeance. God will wash his feet in the blood of the wicked." God will wash the feet of the righteous in the blood of the wicked, and the righteous will then rejoice when he sees that justice of God being meted out. But I thought we weren't supposed to rejoice over the fall of our enemies. Not only is this psalmist, Solomon's father David, not only is he rejoicing over the downfall of his enemies, he's washing his feet in their blood. Psalms 52, verse 6, Another Psalm of David. David says, "The righteous will see and fear and will laugh at him," referring to the evil person with a treacherous tongue in an earlier part of Psalm 52. So here we have righteous people, New Testament and Old Testament, rejoicing over the fall of the unrighteous. So how do we reconcile these two sets of scriptures? Well, this is how John Gill does it, and I believe he's correct. He said that we need to make a distinction between the enemies of God who fall and one's personal enemies who fall. Gill says it is perfectly okay to rejoice when the enemies of God fall, but when your own personal enemies fall, that's a no-no. Now, let's look at Gill's attempted solution. I read you Obadiah 1:12-13, and Obadiah over and over says, "Judah, sons of Judah, don't rejoice when the Edomites fall. Don't boast in their day of distress, in the day of the disaster. Do not gloat over their calamity." In other words, don't have feelings of personal revenge in your heart. We also read in Proverbs 17:5, David says, "He who mocks the poor taunts his maker. He who rejoices at calamity will not go unpunished." Well, that sounds like it's an enemy of the person who is doing the mocking. This is not a righteous cause he's rejoicing at. He's rejoicing at the calamity of some poor schmuck who opposed him. It's a personal enemy. And to boot, it actually sounds like the mocking man is mocking an innocent poor man, not just any poor man. The poor man is being mocked by an unrighteous cad. I think Gill is correct there. I think that's how you reconcile those verses. It's real hard to separate your enemies from God's enemies. But remember, vengeance is God's. He'll take care of his enemies. Our job is not to wish bad things on them, except those bad things that come from the justice of God. And it's real easy to substitute our desire to see them go down with God's justice. God will execute his justice when he's going to execute it. And sometimes that is at a time too far in the future than we desire. And so then our thoughts turn to personal revenge. That's a no-no. We shouldn't do that. We go now to Proverbs 24, verses 19 through 20. "Do not fret because of evildoers or be envious of the wicked, for there will be no future for the evil man. The lamp of the wicked will be put out." Now we just read in verse 1 of this chapter, Proverbs 24, Solomon says, "Do not be envious of evil men, nor desire to be with them." I've already mentioned that with the Hugh Hefner example. Oh, you might be envious of Hugh Hefner. No, no, you don't. No, you won't be once you find out the truth. Well, the same idea is repeated here in verse 19. Now, it seems that Solomon borrowed these words from his father David. Don't be envious of evildoers. David in Psalms 37 verse 1 says, "Do not fret because of evildoers. Do not be envious toward wrongdoers." David says in Psalm 37 verse 7, "Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who carries out wicked schemes." Oh, that's a good verse for those of us who are disgusted by the current rulers of America. They're prospering in their way. They're carrying out wicked schemes. Or if you were in China, the same thing. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. It's hard. Solomon says the same thing in Proverbs 23:17. "Do not let your heart envy sinners, but live in the fear of the Lord always." Don't envy sinners. Proverbs 24:1, "Do not be envious of evil men, nor desire to even be with them." Now, Solomon says in verse 20, there's no future for the evil man. That's why you shouldn't be envious of them. They're going to die. They might be prospering temporarily, but they're going to get theirs in the end, so don't want what they've got. Their lamp is going to be put out. Now, that is a metaphor that I think means to mean that they're going to die, or that God will take away their prosperity and happy life before they die. Bildad in Job 18 verses 5 through 6 says, "Indeed, the light of the wicked goes out, and the flame of his fire gives no light. The light in his tent is darkened, and his lamp goes out above him." Now that sounds to me like Bildad is using the metaphor to refer to a wicked person who is going to die. Job 21:17, Job says, "How often is the lamp of the wicked put out, or does their calamity fall on them? Does God apportion destruction in his anger?" Doesn't say death, but it sounds like it. They're destroyed, at least. David says in Psalm 37:38, "But transgressors will be altogether destroyed. The posterity of the wicked will be cut off." Doesn't mention a lamp being cut out, but it talks about being the wicked being destroyed and cut off, and I think that's what's being referred to when the lamp is going out. Solomon says in Proverbs 13:9, "The light of the righteous rejoices, but the lamp of the wicked goes out. Proverbs 20:20, he who curses his father or his mother, his lamp will go out in time of darkness. That's a great metaphor. Think of a candle going out. Think of the wicked. Their candle's going out, so don't want what they've got. We go now to Proverbs 24, verses 21 through 22. Solomon says, my son, fear the Lord and the king. Do not associate with those who are given to change, for their calamity will rise suddenly, and who knows the ruin that comes from both of them. Now, the son that's being talked to here, of course, people always debate who that son is. I'm going to assume it's a physical son of Solomon. Fear the Lord and the king. Why? Because the king is assumed here to be carrying out the commands of the Lord. And so if you fear both of them, and that means reverential fear, not servile fear, if you fear both of them, obey them, then you're not going to get destroyed in the calamity that will rise suddenly upon those who oppose the Lord and the king. So fear the Lord and the king, that idea is also in the New Testament scriptures. Again, this is very important to obey the king in the New Testament because these people had experienced the freedom that comes from the Holy Spirit. It's very easy to go from there. Oh, I'm free spiritually. I'm free. I'm free. I'm free. Oh, I'm free from the bonds of government. I can do what I want to do. Peter says in 1 Peter 2:13 through 17, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. Fear the king. Peter says in verse 17, at the very end, he says, fear God, honor the king. Very similar to what Solomon says in Proverbs. Paul, the other major apostle in the New Testament, says in Romans 13, verses 1 through 7, every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. Fear the king. Verse 2, therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they will receive condemnation. Verse 5, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, because of fear of what the government will do to you, but also for your conscience's sake, because it's the right thing to do. Render fear to whom fear is due, Paul says in verse 7, Romans 13. Now, I am absolutely convinced that Paul and Peter are talking here of submitting to rulers who are exercising basic morality that's common to all people, pagans as well as Christians. Now, if I had a government official who says, you are not going to worship Jesus, I would either mentally or verbally tell that government official where to get off. You're not going to tell me I can't worship Jesus. In fact, Peter himself, when the Sanhedrin said, no more preaching about the gospel here. You're causing an uproar, Peter. Peter and John was with him, I think, and they said, we cannot help but tell about what we've seen. So sorry. Again, when, for example, Paul tells a wife to be submissive to her husband, he's assuming normal family relations. He's not assuming that the husband has just told the wife to go out and become a porn star. I think people get too carried away with these absolutist views of the scripture. Now, there's an interesting phrase in verse 21 that I love. There's a translation problem involved here. Solomon says, do not associate with those who are given to change. What? What's wrong with that? Aren't we all in favor of change? Don't politicians always say, I'm progressive. I believe in change. I remember the conservative intellectual and commentator William F. Buckley. Decades ago said, why do people always say that conservatives, political conservatives, don't want change? He says the ruling orthodoxy is liberal, and we want to change it. So there's nothing wrong with associating with those who are given to change. Why does Solomon say that? I mean, even the most hide-bound conservative or reactionary wants change of some sort. All human institutions are in need of reform at some time. I mean, look at America today. The CIA is corrupt. The FBI is corrupt. The IRS is corrupt. Everything is corrupt. We don't need change. Yes, we do. So I'm not supposed to associate with those who are given to change, who want to change things? That's a difficult phrase there. But other translations don't translate it that way. The NIV says, don't associate with the rebellious. The Holman Christian Study Bible says, my son, fear the Lord as well as the king, and don't associate with rebels. Now we're talking about revolutionaries, not just people who won't change. The Holman Christian Study Note says that the phrase there could be translated as those given to change, and the NASB takes that translation, as does the KJV. But that's a terrible translation, in my humble opinion. Nothing wrong with wanting change. But now, revolution? No. People die in revolutions. And I can hear an American saying, well, what about the American Revolution? That is the most misnamed movement in the history of history. A revolution tries to overthrow the government. The American colonists weren't trying to overthrow the British government. They were trying to secede from the British government. A revolution overthrows the established religion. The American colonists weren't trying to overthrow the established religion of the Anglican Church. They were trying to get out from under it. In fact, they had freedom of religion. They weren't trying to destroy religion. They weren't trying to destroy morals like the revolutionaries, the moral revolutionaries of today, the woke leftists are trying to do in America. They weren't trying to do that. They were just trying to be left alone. They were saying, don't tread on me. Leave me alone. We're not trying to overthrow you, Britain. Go about your business. So it would not do to apply Proverbs 24:21, even translated as don't associate with those who are rebels. That would not do to apply that to the American so-called revolutionaries. Same thing with the South in the Civil War. The Southerners were not revolutionaries. They were not trying to overthrow the government in Washington. They were trying to get out from under it. There's a big difference. But now, if you're in the French Revolution in 1789, you want to change the weekdays from 7 to 10. You want to put people under the guillotine just because they are the established government. You are trying to overthrow the government. Same thing with the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia at the beginning of the 20th century. I really think the Christians need to wait a long, long time before they get involved in revolutionary movements. I would not do so. I would just put up with it. I say that. I might change my mind. But Solomon here says that you do that, your calamity will rise suddenly. Now, at the end of verse 22, Solomon says, who knows the ruin that comes from both of them, from both of whom? Is it both the Lord and the king? In verse 21, my son, fear the Lord and the king. Who knows the ruin that's going to come from the Lord and the king when you get involved in a revolution? Or it could be that both of them refers to rebels in civil and religious things and those who mingle with them. Who knows the ruin that comes from those who are given to rebellion and those who associate with them, both of them, the associates of revolutionaries and the revolutionaries themselves. Not really sure which way Solomon meant it. We go now to Proverbs 24, verses 23 through 25. These also are sayings of the wise. To show partiality in judgment is not good. He who says to the wicked, you are righteous, peoples will curse him, nations will abhor him. But to those who rebuke the wicked will be delight, and a good blessing will come upon them. Now in verse 23, Solomon says, these also are sayings of the wise. I say Solomon, it might be the compiler of the book of Proverbs, because now the Proverbs are not said to be explicitly of Solomon, but are rather sayings of the wise. Now this section of Proverbs is from verse 24 to verse 34 of Proverbs 24. Well, what are the options as to who wrote these Proverbs? It could be, option number one, that these wise men's sayings belong to other wise men besides Solomon. Or they could be Proverbs of Solomon himself. Adam Clark takes the second view that these are Proverbs of Solomon. Clark says that these are probably fragments of sayings, that these refers to verses 24 through 34. Verses 24 through 34 are probably fragments of sayings collected by wise men from the Proverbs of Solomon. So, in effect, the author is Solomon. And I think what clinches it for me is one of these Proverbs in this section, in Proverbs 24, verses 33 through 34, this proverb is clearly almost like Solomon's proverb in Proverbs 6, 10 through 11. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, then your poverty will come as a robber, and your want like an armed man. Well, that's exactly what Solomon said in Proverbs 6. So we're going to assume we're still talking about Solomon here. So Solomon says in verse 23, to show partiality in judgment is not good. Why would a judge show partiality? Well, because of a bribe, because he's related to the defendant, and he doesn't recuse himself because of bias, or maybe he's friends with one of the suitors in a lawsuit. The common problems that one finds in judicial systems, and they are not good. Here's some other scriptures. The law actually prohibited partiality in judicial judgments. Leviticus 19:15. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great. But you are to judge your neighbor fairly. Rich or poor, economic status doesn't matter. What matters is justice and the facts. Deuteronomy 1:17, you shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall hear the small and the great alike. You shall not fear man, for the judgment is God's. The case that is too hard for you, you shall bring to me, and I will hear it. The judgment is God's. It doesn't matter whether the plaintiff is high and mighty or whether the plaintiff is low and debased. Justice is blind to the economic status of the parties in dispute. Now, Elihu says in Job 34, verse 19, who shows no partiality to princes nor regards the rich above the poor? For they all are the work of his hands. Who does this? Who shows partiality? It's not God. James 2, verses 1 through 3. James says, my brethren, do not hold your faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism. For if a man comes into your assembly with a gold ring and dressed in fine clothes, and there also comes in a poor man in dirty clothes, and you pay special attention to the one who is wearing the fine clothes and say, you sit here in a good place, and you say to the poor man, you stand over there, sit down by my footstool. Remember, the churches were in houses then. A footstool would be in a house. You stand over there, sit down by my footstool, you poor guy who's not a big shot. That is horrible. Social class has always been an attribute of mankind and always will be. It'll never be wiped out. And so we are exhorted here to ignore social class. So we are exhorted here to ignore social class in our church meetings. And Solomon says to ignore social class in the judicial system. In verse 24, Solomon says, he who says to the wicked, you are righteous, peoples will curse him, nations will abhor him. Now, that sounds just like the people in America today who are saying that it's perfectly okay for homosexuals to marry each other, perfectly okay for somebody to choose their gender at birth and then switch their genders, not a problem, just because God said that he made human beings male and female. Well, we don't care what God says. Well, sooner or later, peoples are going to curse peoples like that, and nations are going to abhor woke leftists like that because they are advocating things that are against the very laws of creation. They are like people who say, oh, you can jump out of the top of the Empire State Building, flap your hands, and you will fly. Well, people might believe them for a while, but when the corpses start piling up at the bottom of the building, people are going to say, you know what? These people are full of it. I curse them. I abhor them. Verse 25, Solomon says, but to those who rebuke the wicked will be delight, and a good blessing will come upon them. Well, let's take a moment and pause here and rebuke the woke leftists who say that it's all right for men to enter into a quote-unquote marriage, a so-called marriage with other men. Let's rebuke them right now. It's a delight to do that. Not that we don't love them, not that we don't want them to come to repentance, to be saved from the inevitable doom that's coming upon their heads for what they're doing, but let's rebuke their sin right now. It's a delight. A good blessing will come upon those who do that. Now, of course, you're not going to find Protestant pastors doing that because they might lose their tax-exempt status. Now, here's a couple of scriptures to back up what Solomon says in verse 24 of Proverbs 24. He who says to the wicked, you are righteous. Solomon says, he who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the righteous, both of them alike are an abomination to the Lord. In other words, those who commit a moral inversion, saying that good is bad and bad is good, which is exactly what's happened in America today. These people are an abomination to the Lord. Isaiah 5:23. These bad people who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. We go now to Proverbs 24, verse 26. He who gives an honest answer gives a kiss on the lips. The NIV says, an honest answer is like a kiss on the lips. And this is not a romantic kiss. This is a friendly salutation. It's the way they did it back then. I'm assuming this is man to man, but today it better be a woman who gives me an honest answer before she gives me a kiss on the lips. But the main point of this proverb is not the kiss on the lips, but it's rather the honest answer, because many times people don't want to hear an honest answer. Tell me, am I fat? Well, that's hard to tell somebody if they are actually fat, that yes, you are fat. It's hard to do, especially if you're president or a king and you ask your counselor, is this the right policy? Oh, no, sir, I could never disagree with your policy because you know everything because you're the big shot that got me here. Proverbs 24:27, Solomon says, complete your outdoor work and prepare your field, afterward build your house. One has to eat before he can build a house, so Solomon says, plant your field so you can eat. As Ellicott says, first till the ground and then build the house which will be maintained by the produce of the field. Now here's a modern analogy. Kids who want to buy a sports car before they get an education, people get their spending priorities out of whack. Happens all the time. Go now to Proverbs 24, verses 28 and 29. Do not be a witness against your neighbor without cause, and do not deceive with your lips. Do not say, thus I shall do to him as he has done to me. I will render to the man according to his work. Now, when Solomon says, do not be a witness against your neighbor without cause, that does not preclude being a witness against your neighbor with cause if there is cause. And in fact, if there is cause, you are required to go to court and testify if you're so called upon to do that, if you're subpoenaed, in other words. But don't make up lies about your neighbor. Again, this is one of those anti-perjury verses that we see all through the book of Proverbs. Here's another proverb that expresses the same sentiment in Proverbs 25, verse 18. Like a club and a sword and a sharp arrow is a man who bears false witness against his neighbor. You might as well go next door and beat him over the head with a club, stab him with a sword, and then pull the bow and run an arrow through him if you lie about him in court. In verse 29, Solomon says, do not say, thus I shall do to him as he has done to me. That's the opposite of the golden rule. I will render to the man according to his work. Revenge. Well, we know that the scriptures do not advocate revenge. In fact, they prohibit revenge. Romans 12, 17. Paul says to the Romans, never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. Let them alone if somebody's done you bad. Romans 12, 19. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. You don't need to take revenge. God will mete out his justice at the appropriate time. Matthew 5, 43-45, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies, and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven, for he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. So even though they're evil, and even though they have done you wrong, you don't wish evil on them, you pray for them. In fact, all these woke people that I've been inveighing against, I do take some time to pray for them. Some of them are in the elect, I guarantee you. Some of them are going to see the error of their ways, and they're going to repent of their sins, and they're going to come out. We need to pray that they do so, along with all the other Americans who are not woke, but who are sinning grossly and manifestly, whether it be materialism or whatever else it might be. We go down to Proverbs 24, 30-34, and we will finish this chapter of Proverbs. Solomon says, I passed by the field of the sluggard and by the vineyard of the man lacking sense, and behold, it was completely overgrown with thistles. Its surface was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. What I saw, I reflected upon it. I looked and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. Then your poverty will come as a robber and your want like an armed man. A robber comes very quickly without notice. You want to get poor real quick? Real quickly, you want to get poor fast? Lie down and sleep. Fold your hands, rest, and don't work. Now, there's lots of verses against being lazy. There's also some verses against working too hard to get rich, too. We went over in the last chapter. I won't mention them, but I will mention these proverbs against being lazy. Proverbs 6 has a proverb that sounds very similar. How long will you lie down, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. There's a little bit of meter to that. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. Easy to remember. Your poverty will come in like a vagabond or like a robber, and your need like an armed man. Proverbs 10:4, poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. Proverbs 12:24, the hand of the diligent will rule, but the slack hand will be put to forced labor. You can either be a ruler or a slave. Be lazy, you be a slave. Proverbs 19:15, laziness cast into a deep sleep, and an idle man will suffer hunger. Proverbs 26:13-16, the sluggard says, there's a lion in the road. A lion is in the open square. And what that means is, either there is actually a lion in the road, in the square, and I'm too lazy to go out and do anything about it, so I'm just going to lie here and wait till somebody else does it. Or it could be that's just a made-up phony excuse as to why the sluggard can't get out of bed and go to work. Not really sure what Solomon meant there. Could be either one. Verse 14, Proverbs 26, as the door turns on its hinges, so does the sluggard on his bed. The sluggard buries his hand in the dish. He is weary of bringing it to his mouth again, so lazy he can't even eat. The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can give a discreet answer. So now with that exhortation against laziness, we are now prepared to move diligently on into Proverbs 25 in our next audio, which I will entitle Proverbs of Solomon Part 16. I hope to see you then so that we can pick up some more wisdom, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.